Welcome to the Land Jam Podcast, a semi-friendly discussion between two blokes on watches, cars, and everything in between. Now, here are your hosts, Tommy and Sanjeev.
Welcome to the Land Jam Podcast, episode 62, The Speedmaster Mark IV and Others.
Yeah, so this is kind of a new watch alert episode, Sanj. I mean, technically, it's not a new watch. I've had it for over a year. It's been in the shop for most of the time.
And on your wrist for a past couple of months.
Yeah, it's been great. So we've been due to do this episode, but I'm glad we finally sat down to talk about it.
Yeah, I mean, this was one in the making. I mean, you know, besaddled. We were hit with a bunch of delays, not just the watch, but health reasons and
Sanj, life, I mean, in for general. People who are listening, Sanj has been battling a bug for the last week plus. How are you feeling, Sanj?
Almost there. I can see the light at the end of the tunnel, and I will only stop. I'll stop there because it was brutal. Yeah, let's not get into specifics.
Well, it's time
to know the details.
I'm glad that there's 1,000 miles between us right now. Okay, so that's good. You keep your whatever away from me, but yeah, good to hear you're on the rebound. You know, so that's so that's why this episode's a little bit late, but you know, better late than never. And look, it's an exciting watch. So you know, what are we talking about today? This is the Omega Speedmaster Mark IV. Are you familiar with Mark series at all, Sanj? Have you ever handled one?
So I've never handled a Mark IV myself. And I wouldn't be like the first point of contact or reference for anything that's Omega Speedmaster related. But I do have a general understanding of the different Mark types and variations of it. And mostly thanks to you, since you are a big Omega Speedmaster fan, but also a collector as well. You had a few Speedmasters, whether it's the Auto or the Professional, and now the Mark IV.
Yeah, I had a reduced, which scratched the itch, but not fully. Then I swapped it for the Professional. But I've always wanted a Mark series, you know, because I think the Mark series is a really, really unique kind of a snapshot in time for Omega, you know? So, you know, just for people who don't know anything about the Mark series, the Speedmaster Mark IV, you know, this was basically designed during the immediate wake of the moon landings, right? In 1969, when Apollo 11 happened and they landed on the moon, Omega already was iterating on the Speedmaster, right? So once the Apollo program was in full swing, you know, Omega looked at the Speedy and said, okay, you know, the Speedmaster really is a racing watch. It's been adopted for this, you know, historic mission to the moon. But you know, now that we've accomplished that, what should it look like? What should, now that it's become a space watch, what should the future look like? So it looked at the Speedy and tried to answer kind of what's next, right? So 1969, they released the Mark II version. So the Mark II really was this, you know, quote unquote, the same watch as the Mark I. It had the same 861 mechanical movement, but it was in a different kind of case. It was in a cushion case as opposed to the classic Speedy Pro case that we all love. That was supposed to...
Right, was that...
Yeah.
Yeah, was that a bit more like fitting of the time? Because there were, you know, cushion cases were a little bit more prominent in watch designs back then, right?
Yeah, I do think cushion cases kind of had their kind of time, you know, around kind of late 60s, 70s. You know, there was a lot of playing with, you know, kind of a lugless design. So, yeah, I mean, I think it reflected kind of their ideas of the evolution of design and kind of what a future, quote unquote, space watch would look like. But it also was indicative of what other, you know, watch companies were doing at the same time. So, you know, it's not completely out of the blue. But the Mark II is really limited in what changed, right? I mean, it's basically you're taking the guts of the Speedmaster Mark I, whatever, quote unquote, the Professional, putting it in this cushion case and calling it a new watch. Really, the Mark III and IV kind of, you know, showed the change, right? So the Mark III and IV featured the Caliber 1040 automatic movement. So this is the Le Mania 1340 movement. These are the first automatic Speedmasters. So that's kind of what makes them a special step, you know, removed from the Mark One and the Mark Two. The Caliber 1040 is automatic, quick set date, 24 hour indicator, which is really cool. And, you know, 22 joules, 8,000 frequency. And then it's got around 44 hours of power reserve. So, you know, it's a really kind of built out movement, right? It's a bit advanced for its time. The Mark IV is unique in that it was produced solely in 1973. It had a very, very short run. It was quickly superseded by the Mark 4.5. And the difference really between the 4 and the 4.5 also had a cushion case. It had a day-date indicator. That's the quick way to tell them apart. The 4 only has the date. That's really what, you know, what the big design difference is. The 4 and the 2 kind of are similar design. You know, they both have kind of that similar barrel case design, you know, or cushion case, however you want to call it. You know, Fratello says, you know, quote, the polishing is identical. The case has a sunburst finish on the top, brushed sides, and a slim polished edge on the side. So visually, it's very, I'm looking at it right now, and visually, it's subtle, but there's a lot going on with the polishing. You know, it kind of pops. It's really cool. And the differences, you know, kind of don't stop there, right? So like the Mark One obviously has a tachymeter that's, you know, a ring around basically the bezel. Mm-hmm. Basically around the dial, sorry, around the actual crystal. What am I saying? The crystal. Whereas the Mark IV's tachymeter is within the crystal. So it's printed on the crystal edge and kind of gives the whole design kind of depth, right? Because you kind of
step. Oh, I see it. Yeah.
It's not on the outside, like, it's within the watch.
It's not like a chamfer or they call it like a rehaut in French.
Okay.
This is a bit more flattened surface. It's as if it's printed just underneath the crystal. Yeah, exactly. There's one picture on the Fratello that kind of highlights this.
Yeah, it's a really cool design, and it is visually interesting, you know, in relation to the Mark One, because, you know, if you look just around the dial and the tachy on a flat looking down, you know, looking down angle, you wouldn't necessarily catch it, but when you wear it, really the Mark IV is everything is inside basically the crystal. There's nothing on the outside except the buttons. So it's kind of a cool kind of design. And the other visual thing, and which I think is my favorite design in here, is how Omega kind of pulled off the 24-hour indicator. So
yeah, I had no idea when you first told me about this watch, and you kind of had to point it out to me. But when I saw it, it's like, I can never, ever miss it again.
Yeah. So, you know, the cool thing about this watch, you know, as far as how Omega executed the design, it's really cool. So you have basically only two subdials, right? So when you hit the chronograph, there's a chronograph seconds that jumps from 12, right? The totalizer is a little, basically a plane, you know, it's got wings. That counts the minutes as you go along. So that's also a central minute counter, chronograph minute counter, which is highly
kind of
after. Yeah, it's like a very Lemania 5100 kind of thing, you know? So
yeah,
very attractive. I love that. Then at the 6 o'clock, you've got one of the subdials. That's the subdial for the hours, right? And then at 9 o'clock, you've got something really special going on here. You've got a running seconds hand, right? So that's fine. But also, if you look really closely, there's a little triangle. And basically, that subdial is graduated for 24. And what Omega's done is snuck in basically a 24-hour indicator in that subdial, sharing basically the same real estate as the running seconds.
Seconds time.
It's
so basically, really cool. It grouped all, let's say, the non-chronograph timing into separately, but at the 9 o'clock, anything to do with, let's say, a running time,
yes,
but it's all grouped there.
Yes, and it's a mini, basically, not it's kind of like a mini Batman, because, you know, from six to 18, it's blue. And then from 18 to 6 at the top of the subdial, it's black, you know? So it's very subtle. You really have to look at it. Oh, maybe it's not blue, maybe it's gray. It's really, really subtle, but it's a really, really cool design. It's like my favorite thing about this watch is how minute and subtle that little difference is, but it's executed so thoughtfully and so well. It's really cool. It's really cool.
Now, was that the party piece that, or the one feature of that watch that kind of gave you the go ahead? It's like, I need to get this watch because of that. Was that the key decision maker, or was there something else about the watch?
No, for me, it was important to capture that important era, that significant era in Omega, right? In the Speedmaster story, because, you know, in many ways, that was the time when the Speedmaster was making its kind of reputation, right? So they were really trying to do something different. They were trying to make something modern and really iterative on the original Moonwatch. So I thought that was significant. As far as how I picked it, you know, I really didn't care for the Speedmaster Mark III case. I thought it was too high. Even though the movement is basically the same, I found it to be too high on the wrist and kind of too chunky. Same for the Mark V, which was basically, I think they call it the Speedmaster Teutonic. I found that to be kind of a weird design. The 4.5 I liked, and I think I've talked about this with you, but I just felt that the date took up too much real estate on the dial. I thought that was too much, you know, visually, huge white window there. So I, you know, really for me, the Speedmaster Mark IV is the perfect automatic Speedmaster Mark series watch, right? I mean, that
got it.
It's got a date window and it's got every other feature. It's got two subdials, but it's got that quirky 24-hour indicator. I think it's a perfectly executed watch. I actually got it obviously secondhand from a guy in Massachusetts. So he's local. He's from Western Mass. He had the original unused Omega Lynx. The bracelet was it's upstairs. I'm not a huge fan of it because I actually feel like the bracelet doesn't taper enough. So for me, I didn't think it didn't feel comfortable enough. He was actually wearing it on a Forstner aftermarket bracelet, which kind of like a bullet design. I don't know if you know what that sounds like, a bullet bracelet.
No. Let me see.
They kind of look like, they kind of look like bullets on top of each other. Forstner did it again for their reissue of their famous CIA 24-hour watch, the one that
SR-71
pilots used to wear.
I know this. My Speedmaster, my Seamaster has something similar.
Bullet bracelet.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's a cool design, you know. So
I think that's a classic Omega design.
I agree. And this is what Omega probably should have done instead of, you know, basically what they released, which was a lot thicker and didn't taper. This one tapers just enough. So you got a comfort out of it. So no, all in all, it's a great kind of release. You know, to me, it's always been a mystery why Omega never reissued the Mark series. And that's not true. They've reissued the Mark II, right? And they have that Mark II Racing.
I think the Mark II got some traction, but Mark III and 4 and 4.5.
Mark
III
and Mark IV, they never really touched it. And Omega has no fear of doing automatic Speedmaster releases. They have a slew of them, right? I've always found it kind of strange that they never really dipped into that well, considering all the other wells they've dipped into. You know, if you ask me, it's ripe for a reissue. I would, if I was in Omega shoes, I would say, yeah, of course, why not? You know, it's got kind of a small cult following. I don't know if you know Chuck. Do you know Chuck Maddox?
No.
He was kind of big into the Speedmaster scene like many years ago. I think he may have passed away since then, but he kind of did a lot of the early research pre-internet days on the history of the Speedmaster different models. He kind of kept the flame alive on the Mark series, you know, when really it wasn't a very popular line. I'm not even sure it's any more popular today, to be honest. I don't know. I don't know
the
if you
thing
have
is
any
that,
coffee.
like, I prefer the Mark III and 4.5 versus some of their, let's say, the Speedy Auto releases that they have in the collection and at retail. Like, some of them just don't look great at all. And
Yeah, there are some weird like speedy racing. I don't know. Have you ever liked the Speedmaster? Who is that guy? He's your brother's favorite driver.
oh, Michael Schumacher.
Like the Schumacher watches. I think there's a couple iterations I like, but some of them just kind of feel a little bit too, I don't know,
Too much.
moonswatchy almost.
Either Moonswatchy or too Monaco, Las Vegas, pretentious. Like,
Yes,
it's just too much.
too much, too much. That's kind of why I like the Mark IV series because you know it is a professional watch. You know, it's the next iteration of the Speedmaster professional series. It's not doing anything really beyond that. So yeah, no, look, I think it's a great release. I would, if you're a Speedmaster fan, if you're into vintage, go hunt for one. I gotta warn you, these automatic Speedmaster Mark watches are a bit of a nightmare to service. So I would
Yeah,
really.
that was one thing, is the serviceability. I know you had huge problems,
Yes.
hence the massive delay, but
I mean, basically there were parts that needed to be fabricated slash retrieved or harvested from other watches. And my watchmaker, God bless him, you know, he had to really scour the world for that. And then when he fixed the actual movement, I still had an issue with the hands basically touching each other. So I would run the chronograph and then hit the reset button, and then it would take a bunch of hands with it. It would take the minute hand with it, you know? So, which meant basically the hands were bent.
Yes. I mean,
And
you made your watchmaker travel to, like, the Far East, mountains of Mongolia
he
and the
was like Indiana
monastery.
Jones, you know? Yeah, you know.
Yeah.
This is the scene in Indiana Jones when like he jumps on a plane and then like you see the map in the background and like he's
Yeah.
in all these far off places. But no, it wasn't that bad. I mean, basically he told me that Omega maintains a massive parts database. And what he had to do is figure out the hands that were used in my Speedmaster, confirm that they were actually the hands that were, you know, supposed to be there. He'd have to go to like original catalogs and like, compare the part numbers. And then basically scour the Omega database to see if any watchmaker or any watch servicer had these specific hands. And mind you, this is a watch that was only made in 1973. So he either had to get the hands or something that Omega signed off on as approximately the same. So that took a little bit of time, but he was lucky. He got a hit from somewhere else in the States and they shipped it over. I think it took 2 weeks, and then he installed the hands and ready to rock and roll, you know,
I'm
no problem.
glad it wasn't like any embargo or export compliance issues.
Yeah,
Well,
no secret dual use technology or anything like that. He just had to find some, I mean, it must have been like some ancient watchmaker somewhere who like hoarded parts like from 50 years ago. And, you know, it happened to be the hands that I needed. So, yeah, brand new handset. It's got Loom on it. It's awesome.
let me ask you this. Does the 24-hour indicator have Loom in it? At least a triangle.
No, it does not.
Okay. I mean, it's, I don't think that's a make it or break it deal, but I thought that would be just as cool, just to get a bit
It would
more
be
Loom.
cool to see it spin. Yeah, no, it
Yeah.
doesn't. Basically, it's the minute, hour, and chronograph seconds, the central
Right.
seconds. Yeah, chronograph seconds.
Wait, I know you were a bit fan of it. I know I'm a little bit on the fence with the asymmetrical dial because it's only got a subdial at the 6 and 9 o'clock, but I think it really does work well for this watch. I think Zen 142 is another one that kind of works, which is also used in space as well, ironically. But some asymmetry styled watches do work.
Yeah, I mean, I think the date window also kind of gives us some balance, right? Date window 3. Yeah, I mean, you know, it has automatic across the dial, so that also gives you some visual interest on the 3 o'clock to balance out the lack of a sub dial. But no, look, I think the coolest thing about the watch is how Omega fit all this information in such a small amount of real estate. You know, you've got date, chronograph, seconds, 24-hour indicator, everything, you know, minute totalizer, everything is within the dial. There's no, you know, there's no bells and whistles. They've pared down the subdials to two. It's really an achievement. It is.
And Omega used to do like experiment with these kinds of dials and putting as much information from a timing perspective into the dials. Like one watch, which is quirky, but I actually do dig it, is the Omega Flightmaster.
Yes.
From around the same era.
Yes.
And yeah, there's so much information on that dial.
And it's that really is the same era. Like that should really what people should kind of have in their minds when they visualize this watch is kind of something similar, you know?
Yeah. Because I think that was Omega's answer to the Rolex GMT Master because it was aimed at pilots, but it was not as successful. And one could say it was not as attractive as a GMT Master because it had that Mark III style case. It was very bulbous.
Yeah.
And it is a chunky looking watch.
I don't love that case. You know, I do find the case design weird. I didn't realize the Flightmaster was a GMT. I guess I knew that. I just didn't never think of it that way. I always think of it as a chronograph. Interesting.
It's got that too. Yeah. It's got a whole slew of things.
I mean, if you need to get that watch serviced, you know, God bless you. You know, good luck.
It's crazy.
Very brave man to get one of those watches today and try to get
them. Actually, I'm not sure if it is a GMT. Oh, it does have a GMT hand.
A big fat hand.
Blue.
Yeah.
Yeah, good luck.
Good luck with that. You know, I had a heck of a time with just basically a chronograph. You know, forget adding a GMT complication on top of that. But no, look, I you know, don't be scared of vintage. If you're gonna get one, ideally get one that's been recently serviced. You've got some kind of service paperwork. I kind of stupidly probably should have done that. I had an option to get a recently serviced Mark IV. It was not the full set, so I think that's why I hesitated. And it was a little bit more expensive than basically my example. And I took a chance. And frankly, I probably would have saved money if I just actually ponied up the first time, you know? So lesson learned. It's all a story. When you buy vintage, you know, honestly, you're better off just paying up a little extra and making sure it's serviced and in exact good working order when you get it.
Some wise words to tell your children and your grandchildren.
What is it? Penny wise, pound foolish?
Yes.
That's what I did. I was penny wise, pound foolish. So yeah, don't do that. Okay. Get it in good order beforehand. Otherwise, you're doing is keeping your watchmaker employed. That's all you're doing.
I think the other thing is that no matter how much research you do, always have the possibility that you might need to service the watch and it could take a while.
Definitely. I mean, when you buy vintage, you have to go into it knowing that you should have a watchmaker in mind. It's like, you know, buying an old car, you kind of need to have a mechanic in mind, but also, like, you know, don't be upset. Like, that's part of the process. And like, if you have to wait a year, it just makes it sweeter. You know, the Mark IV definitely was almost a year. So, but it's worth it. I love it. I'm wearing it right now. Definitely enjoying it. You know, I'm going to be taking a trip to DC on Wednesday for work. And I've got a couple hours. I may swing by the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum. I might try to catch one of the old Apollo Speedmasters that are on display there. So,
definitely do it. Yeah, are you talking about the OG Smithsonian with the other museums, or the one that's by Dallas, the Udvar-Hazy Center?
Air and Space Museum. That's Udvar-Hazy, right? Or
there's two of them. So Udvar-Hazy is the kind of like the quote unquote extension.
Okay.
But the original is kind of like more located in DC itself.
That's what I'm looking for, because I think that's the only thing I've got time for. I've got 2 hours basically. So before my flight, my meeting is supposedly ending at 2:00. My flights are around 6:00. So I'm trying to squeeze in a quick run to basically the Air and Space Museum before I have to leave. And I think the Speedmasters are on that one, right, Sanj?
I believe you are correct. I believe a lot of the Apollo-related material is out there.
Is out there, yeah. So I have to decide whether I wear the Mark 1 or the Mark 4. So we'll see. That's a big decision.
Well, that is a big decision. Forget the work meeting that you're flying to.
I'm ready for that. I'm set for that. This is what's picking up my time.
Yeah, just, you know, forget closing the deal. This is a bigger priority.
Listen, I'm flying there. The deal is closed, all right? So that's
the deal is closed.
Always be closing.
All right.
That's my new watch alert, a new watch, an old watch, you know, something blue.
Well, I'm glad you got it. I mean, this is a bit of a Dugina repeat in the sense of the servicing, but I think you will enjoy this one a lot more.
I love my Dugina. I wear it all the time. Yeah.
Yeah, but it's not the Speedmaster.
It's true. It's
the lure of the Speedmaster.
I think it's tough now. You know, I'm in my current rotation. What's hot right now? It's the Speedmaster Mark IV. It's the Tudor Black Bay, and the next new watch alert, the Seiko Marine Master 300. So.
Oh boy, I forgot about that.
Yeah, we're gonna have to do one of those reviews later on.
Another Seiko.
Honestly, Sanj, it's pretty great, man. When you see it, you know, Sanj and I are gonna get together in Miami later this month, Sanj.
That's right.
Yeah, I'm gonna be wearing that in the pool. So you can take it for a test drive. I think you're gonna fall in love. I think you're gonna get one.
Right? We gotta coordinate in our watch game here. What are we bringing? Yes.
Yeah, what's on the stable here? You better bring more than one, right?
Be very. I will bring like three or four. How about
three or
that?
Four? Okay. Yeah. What are the three or four coming?
Well, the Fortis is coming, that's for sure.
You can keep that behind. You don't need to bring that.
Hey, I might need that, you know, in case I need to go hand-to-hand combat here.
Yeah, you can throw it at somebody. What else you got?
Yeah, concussion. The concussion maker.
What else?
I will bring for you the Zodiac.
Okay.
The Super Sea Wolf GMT Pro Diver.
I want to see that.
And then what else would I bring? Maybe a Seiko.
Which one?
Probably the SKX.
All right. I mean, I've seen it to death, but sure, why not?
this is a last minute play for me. I already caught two ready to go. What do you want from me?
Good enough. By the way, speaking of Zodiac, our good friend Mike Pearson is coming to Boston for a Red Bar event.
But it's not with Zodiac, with Christopher Ward.
With Christopher Ward, exactly. So he's coming this month. So if I can swing it, I'm going to try to go see him. So
you should. You should.
Next month. Yeah, I'm going to pop in and say hello. It's been a long time.
I mean, before the Zodiac was purchased, I was really in deep thought of getting the Christopher Ward C65 chronograph. That's a very attractive. I love that thing.
You'll do whatever Mike does. All right. If Mike went to join Invicta next, you'd be like, yeah, actually, that Pro Diver is really great. But Invicta
get lost. You know what? I hope your next vintage watch takes 2 years to get to your wrist. All right.
You're like Frank Costanza's mom, you know, and Donna Chang, you know. You'll do whatever you'll do whatever Mike tells you to do. But yeah, no, I'm hoping to catch him. I'll say hello for you too. So shout out to him on the
podcast. Yes, yeah. Looking forward to seeing you in a few weeks. We can do maybe a quick record or pseudo record or whatever it may be.
Definitely.
You might be drunk.
Definitely. I will definitely be drunk. But
this could be the rare occasion that I get drunk. Once a year.
Hopefully you'll relax for once. All right. All right, Sanj. Well, that's one Speedmaster down. What's the other Speedmaster we're going to talk about today?
The most recently released Speedmaster Professional, which is now being called the quote unquote the Daniel Craig. So yes. What is this basically? It's essentially a Speedmaster Pro, but with a white dial.
Okay.
And I th- think why it's called a Daniel Craig. So there was some recent Omega social media which had Daniel Craig posing, and he had on a peculiar speedy that I think we all caught our eye on, and it had a white dial. But at the time, it was never really mentioned by Omega that they were working on an Omega Speedmaster white dial version.
Exactly. Yeah, this was a couple, I would say a couple of weeks ago. It was the first time we saw it. And you know, a lot of people zoomed in and noticed this white dial speedy with the red lettering. And yeah, that became the Daniel Craig.
Yeah, and I think it's a cool way of referencing it, essentially, right? You know, the it, essentially one would think Daniel Craig would be associated more with the Seamaster, given his connection with Bond.
I
But
mean, he has his
hey,
own. I mean, he already has his own Seamaster. He's got that No Time to Die that he helped design. So,
exactly.
yeah. So he's already
But
checked that box. Yeah. So why not?
it's true, but no one calls it the Daniel Craig Seamaster, right? Don't they call it the No Time to Die Seamaster?
Yeah. Correct. Yeah.
So, hey, you know what? If that's what we're going to stick it with, let so be it. I'm cool with that. But this particular Speedy Pro is kind of more of, let's say, the, I would personally call it the more luxurious of the two, and I'll explain why. Because we spoke about it when the most recent update of the Speedmaster Pros got released. What was it, like 2021?
Yeah.
So this Omega has released various iterations of a white dial Speedmaster Pro, most notably back in the day, which was what they call the Alaskan Project.
Yeah.
And this was released, I believe, in 1969. And the reason why it's called the Alaskan Project, it was basically a secret code name that Omega used as part of its code words for its projects. And it's the company only, you know, cited city or a country for top secret projects, and the Alaskan Project was kind of selected for the everything concerning NASA. So the Alaskan Project, just as a summary, was a specially designed Speedmaster, which was meant for extra vehicle activity or EVA on the moon. So it was a very specific type of watch to kind of meet the specifications, such as temperature, which was a big one on the moon.
Yeah.
It was never really used, actually, by NASA, if I'm
You know who
correct.
used it? You
And
know who
in
used it?
Russian cosmonauts.
That's right. Soviet cosmonauts actually used the Alaska Project watch, ironically, not NASA. Yeah.
Yeah, and I'm going to reference an article later on in the episode as we get to it. But yeah, it was Russian cosmonauts, and that kind of threw me by surprise. And it was very nice to see that it actually got essentially flight tested, maybe not on
Yeah.
the moon, but in space. There are also other releases. There was a 2008 release, a 2015 Snoopy Award release, but there was never really, I would say, kind of like a retail mainstream version of a white dial Speedmaster, if I were to claim that. So Omega kind of responded to the market and released it a white dial, and it's essentially that of a Speedmaster Pro currently on sale with the black dial, but with a white dial.
Yeah.
The only why I call it the more luxurious of the two, because it's the iteration that has the sapphire crystal and the exhibition case back.
I see.
So
Okay.
this is not the Hesalite version, which I know you are very picky about.
Okay.
So it's got everything that the other Speedmaster Professional has, such as the caliber 83861, which is, in my opinion, a very incredible piece of engineering for a caliber, mainly because of the average accuracy that it can achieve, which is about 0.5 seconds plus or minus per day.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, it's based off the previous caliber, but a heavily updated one, the 1861.
That's what I have. I have the 1861. Yeah.
Yeah, so they took that, and I think they replaced about 50% or more of the parts and made it META certified, which is basically Omega certification method, which is why you can get the accuracy you can. It's also got some really good anti-magnetic properties because a lot of the components or the key components for regulation is silicon based.
Got it.
The again, the case is the same as the other Omega Speedmaster Pro, so I'm not going to dwell too much into that because we spoke about it before in our previous episodes. But the dial, it's identical in layout to the black dial, but as you can see, it's predominantly white. The sub-register dials are a bit more recessed, just like the black dial. And I think that was an update in general to the Speedmaster Professional.
Got it.
The one little highlight is the Speedmaster lettering, which is in red. I think it gives a nice contrast.
And it's a that bit cursive more. Speedmaster, right? It's Speedmaster.
Exactly.
Got it. Got it.
Yeah. And just like the other Speedmasters, it's got the applied hour markers with loom. And at the 12 o'clock, you got the double circular pip. So all in all, it's just, it's a nice iteration of the Speedmaster. And I actually personally do like it. I think it's a very good execution. I would do a few modifications, subtle modifications to it.
What are you going to modify?
The second sand, I think it'll look really cool in red as well.
You were just talking about how flashy these other watches are that Omega did, and you want to put a red seconds hand. Sick.
What? It's been done before.
Yeah, I guess the Alaska Project did that. Yeah.
Yeah. Why not?
No, I like it. I like that idea too. I like what they did with Daniel Craig. I think it's very clean. I do think there's like a moment right now for white dial watches. I feel like
it's going through.
Is thinking about getting some kind of white dial version. There's like, I think the Rolex Explorer 2 is kind of hot right now. I know Christopher Ward
did get updated.
What's that?
The Explorer 2 got updated, I think last year or the year before.
Okay.
They made some modification. Again, Rolex being Rolex, it's so subtle that it's to the average watch person, it might not be as detectable, but it is. They did make some updates. I think they also made updates to the movement as well. But yeah, I think white is making a bit of a comeback.
It is making a comeback, yeah. And so I'm not surprised that Omega released this, but I love this. This is classic Speedmaster. It's got the same DNA, but it's got a very nice, clean execution. I mean, it's just funny looking at, you know, the Daniel Craig with the raised, you know, minute markers and that kind of depth, and looking at my Mark IV, which like has none of that, but still,
yeah,
you know,
it's yours is a bit more printed, but this is a bit more applied and 3D.
50 years separated, you know, design wise, but still the DNA is there. And I love it. I think it's great. I love the Speedmaster in red. I think that's the right amount of pop. I disagree about the seconds hand in red. I wouldn't change a thing.
Humbug.
Yeah, bah humbug. No, I think they executed this perfectly.
Other thing I actually do like too are the straps. Well, one of them. I do like the bracelet, the metal bracelet. I think it's, as you were saying, it's a throwback to what Omega used to do, which is kind of like the bullet.
Yeah.
And then when they made the Speedmaster update a couple of years ago, they also tapered the bracelet as well based on consumer feedback.
Nice.
And okay, so we talked about it before. You're not a fan of the Sapphire Crystal, given that there's a Hasselblad iteration, because it's more classic to and more original to the original Speedmaster Professional. But exhibition case back and Sapphire Crystal on this watch, do you care?
You know, exhibition case backs, you know, whatever. When do you see them? I just don't really get the point. I'm not against it. You know, I just feel like it's just another point of failure. I just don't get the reason to do it.
Okay. So here are my two cents.
Yeah.
Because this is a hand wound, this, you know, it's not an automatic, right? It's a manual wind.
Right.
You get to see a lot more of the movement because there's no rotor blocking half the watch.
True fact.
So you get to see the whole gear train, all the levers and things like that. I think it just adds a lot of fun to just holding the watch and seeing it, how it all works and interacts.
Listen, if this if you get your socks off doing this, I'm not against it. You do you, boo boo. All right. I got no problem. You know, I'm not paying extra for it, but you know what? If this is
well, you are paying extra for it. I think compared to the Hesselite, I think you are paying extra for it.
Yeah.
I don't remember the pricing of the regular Speedmaster Pro, but I can certainly tell you the pricing of this watch.
Yeah, tell
it's
us.
not cheap. It's not good.
It's never good. What is the pricing?
So because there's three types of straps or bracelets iterations. So you have the stainless steel, which is about $8,100. The rubber strap version is $7,800, and the leather strap is also $7,800.
Yeah, look, I just, you know how I feel. I always crib and complain about this, but it's like Speedmaster shouldn't be this expensive. I just think it's kind of ridiculous, right?
I remember back in the day, it used to be 4 or 5 grand.
Yeah, you know, I just think it's like, it's a tool watch. It's not supposed to be an ultra hot luxury watch, you know, HAUTE, you know, it's not supposed to be that, you know, and you know, everyone wants to do what Rolex is doing and going up market and, you know, whatever. I don't blame Omega for doing this. It makes business sense, but, you know, it is kind of ridiculous. That's just my.
Yeah, it does push the pennies. Reach a bit too high, but you are still, I think that movement is incredible for what it's able to do from an accuracy
from
standpoint.
From a technical standpoint, it's awesome, you know, so.
Yeah.
You know, whatever.
And just like Rolex, Omega does a lot of things in-house. Maybe not to the Rolex degree, but it's basically there, if not almost.
All right, Sench. All right, that's a watch we both love. Fair enough to say?
Yes.
All right, let's go to a watch that I for sure am going to hate.
So this one, I decided to not do much research because I know it's going to be a bashing. But it's the Omega Cross. It's the new Moonswatch release, and this one is the Snoopy iteration. I don't know what they call it, the Snoopy or the White Snoopy, but okay. Essentially it's the Swatch Moonswatch, full white, and it's basically a callback to a combination of the Omega Speedmaster Alaskan Project or the Omega Snoopy Award Speedmaster Professionals. And yeah. It's a full white, a bioceramic case. Even the strap is white. But it's got some little nice little touches.
What, Snoopy's lying down? Snoopy's sleeping? He's on the moon? What is this?
Yeah, it's basically a moon phase complication.
Come on. Okay.
I know that would excite you so much. It's loomed.
All right, Sanj. How much is this going for, Sanj?
I think like $270.
All right. So you were. Let's get the elephant out of the room here because there's a betrayal that we need to talk about. Right. You were in Europe recently, yeah?
Yes, I was.
And you picked up a special little something for somebody. You want to talk about that?
Yes, I picked up a Moonswatch, but not for myself.
Okay. Which one? What was your experience?
This one was, I think, the Project Mercury. It's for my brother.
Yeah.
And which one's it was cheaper. Mercury? I don't even remember what it is. But
yeah,
there's so many versions of them. But it's like got this maroon shade of it. I think it's like maroon and gray.
Okay.
And yeah, I can grab the watch and it's available, but I just need to pull it out and
it's okay.
Oh no, sorry. It's the Mission Caputo. The one he originally wanted was the Mercury, but the duty free didn't have it, so we decided to go for the Mission Caputo. I basically saw it, picked it up, and just bought it. I haven't even opened it at all yet.
Oh, you haven't even given it to him yet?
No, I haven't seen him yet.
Got it.
So,
all right. Well, take some
this
pictures.
This is a Moonswatch. Yeah, it's nice. It's not bad. I mean, okay. So I do have one correction to make. The Snoopy Moonswatch is about $300.
Okay.
This one I picked up, which is at the duty free, was about $250, which is not bad from a pricing point of view at all.
Come on, man. This is something that's going to break in like 6 months. You and I both know that, right?
Hey, maybe it might outlive your Crystal and your Speedmaster Pro.
Yeah, come on, get real.
I just wanted to sneak that in.
All right. Well, you know what you can do? You can put this in a box of cereal and hand this to your brother. All right. It's one of those kind of watches. So
exactly. but as far as the Snoopy iteration is concerned, I think it, I'm not going to buy it, but I think it's one of their better executions of a Moonswatch.
There is some design thought that goes into it, you know, and I do like the all white and I guess some sort of moon. Is that really a moon complication?
I believe it's a moon phase complication. Yeah. I mean, keep in mind, this is a quartz watch. So doing a moon phase complication with electric power and electronics is much easier than mechanical.
Yeah. But hey, still, that's pretty impressive to pull off.
It is.
Yeah. So, you know, hey, all things considered, an interesting release, you know.
Yeah. So it's a moon phase.
But yeah.
Yeah. It's a moon phase indicator. It's got a loom, it's got a message, and I'm referencing a Fratello article, and the message says, "I can't sleep without a nightlight." So it's quirky. I think it's a fun watch, and it just gets people into watch collecting in general.
It's something. And when you said quirky, what did you say? Quirky,
yeah, quirky.
I heard quirky as in Corky Romano, that terrible movie with Chris Kattan. You remember that movie, 2001?
Night at the Roxbury?
Around that era. Yeah, it was horrible. It's called Corky Romano. So
okay.
That's kind of the caliber that I'm putting this watch under. So we'll just move on from there. People that know will know what I'm talking about. So
you know what? I okay. So remember the one that they released, which had like a moon swatch gold or whatever it was, which had like a gold hand?
Yes, yes.
I thought that was ridiculous, right? It's not fitting to, let's say, the original intent of a moon swatch. A moon swatch is supposed to be playful, right? I think this is a bit more in tune of what they're aiming at. It's
I
a lot
the
playful.
Tone is right. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. I think the tone is more appropriate. Yeah, sure. Listen, if you've got $300 to light on fire, go get one.
Yeah.
Moving on.
You would rather spend you'd rather spend your money at the casino.
I would rather drink $300 than do it, you know, spend it on this. But
I look forward to the $30,000 hospital bill that that comes after it to pump your stomach out. All right.
I wouldn't say been there, done that, but I've been close. All right, Sanj, what do you got for watch of buy-in?
So I have two watches. They're not Omega related, but they are kind of fitting of kind of the watches we've been talking about, mainly being white dialed watches. So the first one is another kind of deal going on Joma Shop for the Hamilton Intramatic. I know we kind of put this up whenever it's on sale. And I believe
like the fifth or sixth time we've
plugged it's this on up. Sale, baby. Just get it.
Yeah, it's nice. White dial, automatic.
Yeah, Panda.
Yep.
For $1,558.
Not bad. I like it. What's the next one? What do you got?
And it's got your favorite Hamilton design, the OG Hamilton looking.
Yes, the only Hamilton letter. Logo I like. It's that
yeah.
Slanted diagonal logo. Love it. Love it.
All right. Second one is the Tissot PRX chronograph, also white dial. And it's on sale for $1,325.
Like it. White dial, black sub dials, automatic. Not
I wouldn't be surprised. Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if the movement's very similar to that of the Intramatic since they're all part of the Swatch brand. But
yeah.
Hey. 70s integrated bracelet.
Yeah.
I know some people don't like a chronograph version of the PRX. I'm on the fence depending on the flavor of the month, but I think it's for.
Our cousin has the PRX non-chronograph, and I liked it a lot. I thought that with the honeycomb
Yeah, it's got the texture
dial,
dial.
yeah,
Yeah.
really, really nice. So, I haven't had all the chronograph. I've only seen that version, but I thought Tissot really put together a pretty eye-catching kind of design at the end of the day. So, yeah, hey, listen, vaya con Dios. If the PRX chronograph is up your alley, get it. It's a good execution.
So yeah, also available on German shops. So two Panda chronographs at affordable price points.
Good stuff, Sench. All right, Streaming Gold.
Yeah, let's do it.
Streaming Gold this week is an interesting listen. It's also on YouTube. It's called the Big Dig Podcast. The Big Dig for people who aren't from Boston. Are you familiar at all with the Big Dig, Sench?
Oh yeah, the big construction project, which went over budget but was necessary, and I think in the end of the day was beneficial for the city of Boston.
Yeah, have you seen it? When you came here, did you check out what the Big Dig is now?
I think I walked on the, let's say, the areas that there were highways and they converted into green space. I believe I worked,
You
I
did.
walked
Yeah,
all
yeah.
over
I
them.
remember
Yeah.
one visit you came. We went to what's now considered the Rose Kennedy Greenway. That used to be actually like I-93. And
Yeah.
they put I-93 underground, and they basically have this wonderful green space. But yeah, this is a great, great show. If you're into engineering and design and city planning, it's basically the story of the Big Dig. And it's this the Big Dig for people who are not from Boston was this huge project to basically connect the city to the airport and also to put underground this terrible eyesore, this horrible idea to put basically what they call the central artery, which was the main road in and out of the city, that was above ground and elevated through city of Boston. So, when my wife, first, lived in Boston, when she came for school, and she went to the North End, which is basically where she ended up living for years, that neighborhood was cut off from the rest of the city. You were basically hemmed in by this massive highway spewing out smoke and noise. It was horrible. And
Right.
then, while we were at school, that project came to an end. That was knocked down and everything was put underground. It's a really very few cities in America get that opportunity. A lot of cities have these, this horrible 1950s, 60s idea of putting massive freeways and highways right in the middle of the city, destroying, any ability to walk around or, even breathe the air. So, Boston got a rare redo, and it's a story about this project that was hatched, almost, within years of the actual elevated highway going up, people were already thinking about tearing it down. And how they secured the money and how the engineers worked through a bunch of engineering problems to kind of, make it a reality. You're right. I mean, the project ended up costing $14.7 billion. It is the most expensive highway in all of America by miles, because I think the actual length of the actual project, I want to say it's like 2 miles, maybe. It's really not that much distance-wise, but
Yeah, but it's critical within the city.
critical. And it's incredibly difficult to put a major highway underground in the middle of an area surrounded by skyscrapers. And the most interesting thing is the Gillette factory is in South Boston. They are producing razors during this whole project. And the project, the razors they're producing are like literally like, microns thin. They're like extremely, extremely finely machined pieces of metal. And basically, they told the city that whatever you're doing, whatever blasting and digging you're doing, the machines cannot be disturbed because the tolerances for the razors are that thin. So the
Right.
engineers who were doing this had to make not just, conduct this project and get it done. They also had to do it in a way that, wouldn't disturb anybody, including Gillette, who was very powerful back then. So it's a really cool story, really interesting, not just the budgeting, but the engineering, but also all the different people that are part of it. It's called The Big Dig. It's a podcast, but it's also on YouTube. I'll put the YouTube link if people want to see some visuals. They have some interesting pictures of the people and basically the engineering problems that they're solving. So
I
it's a good
remember,
one.
yeah, I remember learning about the Big Dig back in high school for geography in when I was in Toronto, Canada. And one of the things I remember was like they had to freeze the soil. So they had to come up with a way to freeze the soil so they can work
Yes.
to construct the tunnel, which is
Yes.
insane.
Yes. This is I forgot what they called it, but basically they started doing soil testing and reached a conclusion that some of the soil was just mud. So there was a project to basically one step they had to do to put the pylons in to be able to dig into that mud. They actually froze the mud using enough air conditioning, I think, to cool the Empire State Building or something insane
I'm
like
not surprised. It's insane.
that.
I mean,
It's
for that
insane.
kind of project, you need that kind of energy to, or cooling in this regard, to get it done.
So they were basically cooling it to that kind of temperature, getting it cold enough simply to be able to dig and put the struts and the pylons in. It's
Exactly.
really an
Yeah, it's
amazing
insane.
story. It's an amazing story. I think Bechtel Parsons was the engineering firm that was in charge of basically the Big Dig.
Oh wow, okay. Yeah,
It's a
Bechtel's a huge company.
huge engineering concern. These guys, they butted heads with the city quite a number of times over cost and kind of what their approach was going to be. But it's a really interesting podcast, especially if you're, I think if you have an engineering background, I think you'd enjoy it because it's just project management and how you manage a project from, inception in the 1980s when it was funded to basically opening it, I think 2004, 2003, something like that. That's a long time to work on something like that. So it's pretty
It
impressive.
is. I'm not surprised it was over budget, and we always laugh about projects or complex projects being over budget automatically, no matter what it could be. But I mean, in this regard, it was extremely complicated.
Extreme. I mean, you're digging through a city that's 400 years old. You're hitting, gas lines that people forgot about decades ago.
Yeah.
It's a running project. Plus, the water table's really high. Just a slew of issues. But it's a really interesting story, so definitely worth a listen. My second streaming gold is courtesy of a friend IRL, and also a friend of the pod, maybe Karen. If you're listening, thank you. This is a video about, and it's titled "Why This Obsolete Mechanism Makes Watches More Expensive." It's by Business Insider, and it's about all our favorite complications, Sanj. It is the
Tourbillon.
tourbillon. That's right. You love it. You love to see it. It's basically, what a tourbillon is, and they talk to an independent watchmaker who makes these tourbillon watches today from scratch in France. Pretty cool, kind of see how his work, how he works, and how he designs on the computer and laser cutting and basically doing everything by hand. It's impressive. So definitely check that out. Tourbillons are not my thing, Sanj. Probably not your thing either.
I admire its artistry and the technical difficulty in manufacturing such. It is nice to see it in action. And you have like these tourbillons that are, more, let's say, rotating in multiple axes, which is insane. I think Yigal LeCoultre made one that just rotates in like all sorts of directions, which is insane.
All right, so
It's extreme, but it's cool to see.
I got two words: decadent and wasteful. So that's how I feel about tourbillons. But if you want to check it out, check it out.
You know what? If I win the Powerball, I'm getting you a
I don't want
tourbillon.
it. I don't want
I'm
it.
going to get you an Omega Speedmaster tourbillon. All
No,
right.
keep it, please. I don't want it.
You're getting it.
Get me a
That's my
Daniel
gift
Craig. Get me a
to
Daniel
you.
Craig. I'll be a lot happier. All right. But I guess it's not about my happiness. It's about yours.
That's right. I'll be happy.
That's right. All right. Closing notes, Sanj. What do you got?
So, as I mentioned before, and this is another Fratello Watch article, this one talks about the history of the Speedmaster Alaskan project. It goes into detail of why it was created and the little details like that were used into designing the watch and into the history of the watch as well, including referencing the Russian cosmonauts that wore the Alaskan Project Speedmaster into Soyuz 25. So
That's awesome.
really
Yeah.
cool article. Yeah, I would highly recommend this.
Yeah, I read this a while back. It's an older article, but it's a really interesting read for Speedmaster guys. Love the Alaska project. Obviously, you know, you do see some lines of design carry over to the Daniel Craig, and why not? It's a timeless, beautiful design.
Yeah, and an interesting take of how they many, you know, they came about to designing the case for the watch to experience the extreme temperatures of the moon. So
it's that big red ring, right? It's basically like a
yeah, it's a case
ring
within a yeah on top of the case itself.
Gotcha. It's cool. I like it a lot.
You know what? I'm going to get Omega to commission a special Omega and Alaskan project for you when I win the Powerball that has a tourbillon on the 6 o'clock dial.
Every episode, we talk about what you would buy me if you win the lottery, yet you still haven't won the lottery. So I think you should focus on
I tried with the Mega Millions. I did. I bought 5 tickets for the Mega Millions, and guess how many numbers I got out of all the 5 tickets combined?
How many?
One.
Wow. All right, it's just a matter of time, Sanj. I feel it. Next one, all right?
Next one. I can feel it, Tommy.
All right, well, that is it for this week's episode. Thank you for joining us for another episode of the Land Jam Podcast. Tommy and Sanj here. Please do give us a follow on Instagram. Follow us on Twitter. And please, 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 we do kindly ask you to review the show on iTunes, on Spotify, wherever you hear it. The reviews really help us kind of reach new people. You know, we are a lowly bunch of people. We don't spend any money on marketing. It's all word of mouth. You know, it's
well,
that helps
we
us
do
out.
Buy spend a bunch of marketing. Hey, hang on there. We do spend a bunch of marketing. We buy our own watches.
Fair enough.
That's the marketing.
That's right. And without the Powerball, we can't buy any more watches. So help us out.
Yeah, from a financial point of view, this is a very loss-making project.
It's a loser. It's a big time loser. But no, thanks again for listening. It makes it fun for us. And yeah, until next time, we'll talk soon.